Coming up next, Upstate's HealthLink on air. On tonight's program, we talk about some of the most common winter head injuries that could result in a concussion.
Unfortunately, while we can put a helmet on the head, we cannot put a seatbelt on the brain. So when the head is suddenly stopped by a tree, by the ice, by another person, by the boards, in hockey, the brain is thrown around inside the skull.
Plus, kids being treated at Upstate Golisano Children's Hospital can still attend school. We'll learn how that works.
It is an old-fashioned schoolroom. We provide services K through 12.
And a discussion about positive parenting techniques.
Spanking and other forms of corporal punishment are ineffective, and they have lots of negative ramifications.
We'll get a checkup from the neck up and hear from our healing muse. That's all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, we learn how hospitalized children can continue their classroom studies as an inpatient. Plus, how does the practice of positive parenting influence the way in which we discipline our kids? But first, winter head injuries, their prevention and treatment. As the winter season arrives, families are planning outdoor activities and winter sports. Well, according to the National Pediatric Trauma Registry, many winter sports can result in head-related injuries. And traumatic brain injuries are the leading cause of death and disability in children and young adults. Here with more on this and ways to prevent these injuries is Dr. Brian Rieger. He's the director of Upstate's Concussion Center. Welcome, Dr. Rieger. Thanks for coming
in. Good morning.
So you and I have spoken many times about the hazards of traumatic brain injury and concussions in our kids. But once again, remind us, why is it so devastating when either of these happen, either a concussion or a traumatic brain injury, especially if they're not recognized?
Well, a concussion, first of all, is a so-called mild traumatic brain injury, and thankfully, because concussion represents about 80% of all traumatic brain injury, thankfully, it's usually a short-lived event with no long-term consequences. Where we get concerned is when concussions go unrecognized and untreated, and especially if that leads to a person suffering another injury or experiencing significant stress because they don't know what's going on, they're overdoing it and making themselves worse. So really, my message has always been that if we handle concussion properly, we can have a good outcome.
And usually it occurs because of a jolt or a blow to the head.
Right.
And as I said, winter sports apparently, you know, leave us open to a lot of those kinds of head injuries, especially amongst children and young adults.
Yes, and actually, the first thing to know is that falls are actually the leading cause of traumatic brain injury, especially in the very old and the very young. So as we enter the winter season, all of us should be more careful to try to avoid falling, because it certainly can result in some serious head injury, concussion or worse.
So what do you think of the winter sports seem to be the most dangerous? I mean, is it just all across the board? What stands out to you?
Well, I don't think winter sports are necessarily more dangerous than other sports. Hockey tends to be a winter sport, obviously, and its rate of concussion is quite high, up there with football and other high-risk sports. And there's actually been a lot of attention in youth hockey on trying to reduce the incidence of concussion through rule changes and not allowing kids to start checking and serious contact until they're a little older, things like that.
But it seems to me, just from my own experience, things like sledding, ice skating, skiing, snowmobiling, and snowboarding should all, you know, have the potential for people to fall and therefore have head injury.
Yes, in all of those things that you mentioned, people are going fast. And when you're going fast, your head is moving fast. and a fall or a collision will suddenly stop your head. And unfortunately, while we can put a helmet on the head, we cannot put a seatbelt on the brain. So when the head is suddenly stopped by a tree, by the ice, by another person, by the boards in hockey, the brain is thrown around inside the skull. And it's that mechanical motion of the brain inside the skull that tends to produce traumatic brain injury, including concussion.
The other fact that I noticed when I was kind of looking into this was that winter is a time where driving is more treacherous for most drivers, with ice and snow and the kinds of winters we've had of late. And I know I found some stats that said that car crashes and driving accidents are also the leading causes of death amongst children 2 to 14. So it seems that winter, again, is a time to pay attention specifically to preparing yourself for driving in that circumstance.
Yes, I actually hadn't heard that statistic before. That's interesting. I do know that for adolescents and young adults age 15 to 24, motor vehicle accidents represent a leading cause of traumatic brain injury. And, you know, that combination of young drivers and, unfortunately, young drinkers can be quite problematic. And inexperienced drivers during the winter season, it's going to be particularly rough. So I think special attention to safety on the highways is certainly important to prevent not only head injury, but any kind of injury.
Absolutely. I do remember anecdotally that when my children were at the age to start driving, my husband had the idea that he was going to get football helmets for every one of them in there, so that once they start driving, of course, you know, they certainly were going to be fighting not to wear them. But the idea that we've never actually asked kids to wear helmets as they drive is kind of unique.
Yes.
And potentially there's some value there. But let's get to this idea of helmets for a minute.
Okay.
Because it seems to me, as you said, that while it doesn't totally protect, the role of helmets in any of these sports or activities sounds like it would be a valuable thing to consider.
Yes. Well, this is an interesting question because there's a lot of attention right now to seeing if people can improve helmet design to reduce the risk of concussion. What's important to know is that the helmet is most effective at preventing things like skull fractures or more severe brain injuries. And helmets are very good at that in football, in ice hockey, in snow sports. The risk of severe, moderate to severe traumatic brain injury, the risk of skull fracture is significantly reduced with a helmet. However, again, because the brain is floating inside the skull, a helmet will not prevent a concussion. And it's unclear exactly how much a helmet will reduce the risk of concussion. Certainly, it makes sense that it would reduce the amount of force that's transmitted to the skull. But often it's the twisting motion of the head that is problematic, and the helmet provides no protection against that. So it's very important to wear a helmet to save your life, potentially. In terms of the risk of concussion, what we certainly don't want people to think is, if I have a helmet on, I'm not going to get a concussion, because that is absolutely wrong.
That's a key point. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Brian Rieger, director of Upstate's Concussion Center. And we're talking about winter sports, the potential for head injury and concussion, and how to prevent your kids from winter head injuries. Let's try to go sport by sport right now, just briefly,
sure,
and kind of take into consideration what you can do then, perhaps in addition to wearing a helmet, that might prevent you from having these kinds of head injuries. Let's start with ice skating for a minute. I mean, ice skating is such a wonderful sport. Kids do it everywhere. I mean, you know, you'll see a little pond somewhere or a little, body of water, and it starts to get cold, it freezes over. What are the kinds of things that you suggest to people to be careful with or about?
Well, I think with respect to head injury, at least, I think I certainly encourage people to wear helmets when they're skating, even if they're not playing hockey. In our clinic, we've had numerous cases of people who've just been out ice skating, taken a fall, and had a pretty bad head injury and or concussion. So again, the helmet won't entirely prevent that, but it can certainly help.
It would dampen the effects of the fall, though, to some degree.
Certainly it would prevent the more serious problems, and one would certainly think that it could help to prevent concussion as well, although again, it's a little harder to know that. So I think wearing a helmet's always a good idea. I think what you're going to hear me say with all these sports, too, is that your behavior on the ice is very important. So when you see the little kids whipping around the ice playing tag, there's a good reason that the monitors on the ice don't like that behavior, because it certainly increases the risk not only that they could hurt themselves, but that they could hurt others. And when you're public ice skating, I like to ice skate. I do it a lot with my daughters. And there is varying degrees of skill out there.
Yes.
And someone who's kind of got one hand on the boards and is a little tentative, if a little kid comes whipping by and manages to nudge him, you know, it can cause injury. So I think behavior and safe behaviors on the ice is certainly as much as important as safety equipment.
Yeah, and in addition, obviously, if you're going to be skating on something other than a rink, you really need to know that it's safe ice as well.
Absolutely safe ice, not just in terms of any risk of falling through the ice, such as when you're around moving water, inlets and outlets of lakes, but also the condition of the ice, the surface of the ice, because you can be going pretty fast, and if you hit a divot or you hit a change in ice texture... You can be launched pretty far, and again... You know, skating is a sport where you can get moving pretty quick if you know what you're doing.
How about sledding? Anything that jumps out at you in terms of head injury and sledding?
I would say that, at least in our clinic, anecdotally, I don't know if you have statistics for sledding, but in our clinic, I would say that most of the sledding incidents we see come from individuals who have done things on the sled that probably didn't make much sense, like trying to stand up on a sled to go down the hill, or building the giant jump in the middle of the hill and being thrown off the sled, or sledding where obviously you're too close to trees or other things like that.
And how about this idea of sledding with your feet first, or sitting up instead of lying down head first? Do you feel like that's a good recommendation?
Yeah, I mean, anything that can protect, you know, the biggest problem, one of the biggest problems with sledding incidents is collision with another object. The same is true with skiing. So if your feet go in first, obviously that would make sense, that it would reduce the risk of head injury. Skiing, we have the same problem with, you know, skiing through trees. You know, it's very exciting, especially for kids to do that. It's a way to test your skill. But as soon as you're around stationary objects and you're going fast, it increases the risk of injuries significantly.
And the same would be true for... the idea of jumps and all these things that especially kids like to set up and try. If they're becoming airborne and they literally can come crashing down,
right?
The first thing you worry about besides broken limbs is your head.
Yeah. Well, terrain parks have become very popular in ski resorts, especially with adolescents and young adults. And that has contributed to an increase in injury in that group. Because of risk-taking behaviors.
So in all of these, including snowmobiling or any of these, that safety helmets can help, but why don't you summarize what you're saying?
Yeah, I would say that, first of all, everybody should know how to recognize a concussion and what to do about it. So if one does occur, we're minimizing the risks there. In terms of prevention, certainly consideration should be given to a helmet in any of these sports, not just for concussion, but certainly to prevent life-threatening injuries. And again, I think a theme that runs through everything we've been talking about is the importance of good judgment and behavior that reduces the risk of injury, whether it's safe driving, making good choices about where you're going to ski or sled or skate.
So that really does fall a lot to the parents, I think so. Or some adult who's in some supervisory capacity, to remind your kids to ski safely, to skate safely,
and all of that. In hockey, we have officials who can
When it's a sport competition.
But when we're not there, yes, exactly.
My guest has been Dr. Brian Rieger. He's the director of Upstate's Concussion Center. Thanks again for joining us. Always appreciate you. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Coming up next, how a hospital school is helping kids stay connected and heal. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen along with you. Children and adolescents who require hospitalization for any length of time experience interruption of life and of their most normal and essential activity, school. But that doesn't quite have to happen. And here with more on this is Mary Ellen Michalenko. She's the OCM BOCES hospital teacher at Upstate's Golisano Children's Hospital. Welcome, Mary Ellen. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning.
So school, we all know, school is such an integral part, an essential part, really, of the lives of children and adolescents. Hospitalization has got to be terribly disruptive of that. But you have a program to address this, the hospital school. Tell us about it.
Well, the hospital school program started sometime in the early 1970s. Dr. Howard Weinberger, who was a pediatric physician at the time, knew that the disruption of school of children's school was also affecting their health.
Their ability to heal, perhaps?
Correct. Recovery. So he started to look into a program that would bring in a teacher to work with these children. At that time, it was done by a grant. He tried to get funding through the city school district, but many of our children come from all over the state, so that wasn't working. So then he partnered up with BOCES, OCM BOCES, which is the Board of Cooperative Educational Services, and he brought in a teacher full-time to work with children who were long-term, who were going to be in and out of the hospital, their disruption of school was for an entire school year most of the time. So anyway, that's how the program began.
So what exactly does it look like now?
Oh, what it looks like now is far different from what it looked like then. Way back in the 1970s, the teacher at the time had school on a cart, and she would roll a cart from room to room. But you have to remember at that time, in the old building, we were on 4 or 5 different floors. So we were on 7H, we were on 4A, we were on 8O, and there was also children over at Krause, so she had to go over to Krause. So when I came 1999, full-time here, the hospital provided a room. So I was able to have a school room, small, but a room that I could put my materials in and that children could come to. Only one child at a time, but at least it was large enough. Now it's developed for the new Golisano Children's Hospital into a 20-by-40 room. At the time when the new hospital was being developed, Lukey Soul Foundation funded the money to have the schoolroom on the Golisano Children's Hospital. So I'm on the 11th floor with windows, with all types of technology provided, again, by Lukey Soul Foundation. We have a smart board. We have a computer center. We have room to probably hold 4 or 5 students at one time.
How does it exactly work, though, in terms of how do kids get involved in the program? And, mm-hmm. and do you see more than one child at a time? Is it run like a real classroom?
It's run like a real schoolroom. If there's no infectious disease, I can have many children in the schoolroom at the same time.
And it will be almost like the one old-fashioned
one-room
schoolhouse.
It is an old-fashioned schoolroom.
Mm-hmm. Because you have all kinds of ages.
We do. I am. We provide services K through 12. And again, our school districts go from Binghamton up to Potsdam, up to Messina. We have children from Watertown. We have children as far west of Utica, Copenhagen, as far to the west as Auburn and a little bit past that.
So how often are the classes held? I mean, is this a daily occurrence?
Oh, yes. I'm a full-time New York State certified teacher positioned here in the hospital. My schoolroom days usually go from about 7:30 to 3:30. That's what I say, but many times I'm here longer. And during Regents time or during the state testing, children have what we call testing over multiple days, so they can have their test at any time that they're feeling well. Because sometimes children are not feeling well at 9 to 3, and when the state tests have to be given out, they have to be given out on those days. So it varies, but normally I'm here. The schoolroom's open from about 8 to 3:30.
So what exactly, basically, are your goals? I mean, is it just kind of a holding pattern?
No.
Are you actually trying to advance kids through their curriculum?
Correct. The goal is to have the children re-enter their school where they should be. So when I get a child, I call the school, get in contact with the teacher, and with modern technology, between emails and faxes and scanning, they get their work, what they're doing that day for their school. At the end of the school day, I can scan back all those materials to the teacher.
Wow.
And she can make corrections and send it back the next day.
Wow.
Again, a child, for instance, who has cancer, who is going to be with us for the entire, basically, school year, in and out, we are down to a pattern. So this child, with our Staying Connected program, it's a long-distance learning program that we can connect directly into that child's classroom that day.
So a child in their own hospital room or hospital bed, theoretically, or in your classroom,
correct,
can participate in an actual classroom that of their school district that's being held,
correct,
in real time.
Correct. So this morning, when I came in, I have a child who connects. He's a high school student, and he connects into his school. So the school scanned, and I printed off his materials for the classes that he's in right now. So he's in classes now from 8:23 until 10:57. Then he has a break, and then he's in his afternoon classes.
So he does all that long distance.
He does all that
distance learning.
Long distance learning. Correct.
So in that case, that he's not necessarily being educated in your program per se, but your program is facilitating him continuing his education
Absolutely.
Through his regular district.
And if he has problems with some of his classes, then afterwards we work on things. And it depends also on how he feels. There are some days where he can't connect, but the materials still come into me.
Why is this so important?
You know, the normality of children is going to school. They are thrown into a medical crisis where they have no control over what's going on. When they have control over their school, they know we anticipate them getting better. We anticipate, okay, we have to go through this. It's a medical crisis. You have to go through this. But at the end of the road, we want you to go back into school with your peers where you belong.
So in a sense, it projects some degree of hope.
Absolutely.
And also some normalcy.
Right.
And this idea that there is a future.
Absolutely. And children will tend to stay in their room, especially older children. We want them out of their room. We want them out of their room, into the schoolroom, into something normal that they know.
And there's some, I would imagine, some social interaction that
absolutely.
Goes on as well.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Mary Ellen Michalenko, and we're talking about hospital school, and that's at the Upstate Golisano Children's Hospital. So specifically, overall, how would you state what your goals are in a general sense?
My goals are to always keep any of the children, any of the pediatric patients that I have, on par with what they are doing in school, so they can re-enter back into their school. Also, to help them with any of their testing, the state testing that needs to be done. Again, for older children who are diagnosed and they are in 11th grade and have four Regences in front of them, and let's say they come in February, this is a major concern to them. So we say, look, you can continue the work that you need to do. You can have the testing here in the hospital. Doesn't matter.
You know, that you're hospitalized.
You're here, and we can give you those tests, and you can complete what you need to do.
It's a safe haven, it
Absolutely.
Sounds to me.
Oh, yeah.
And that must really have a very strong impact on their overall sense of peace and less anxiety, not only surrounding hospitalization, but the fact that they're not missing and falling behind.
Exactly. And also, now I spoke a little bit about the older children. Well, the younger children come into the schoolroom because they like to go to school. We actually had one child who did his first day of school coming into the schoolroom in September, and the parents took photos, and it was a big day for him. He had his new backpack, and
wow.
And this is a child who was able to do that first day of school here in the hospital.
That's really significant. Mm-hmm. That must give you a great deal of satisfaction to participate in that. What special skills, if any, I know you're a certified teacher, but as I alluded to earlier, you're almost like the old-fashioned one-room school teacher because you have this vast array of ages and levels that you're addressing. So what special skills, if any, do you think you need to bring to this kind of a task?
Well, I have developed those skills over the year. I started this journey of hospital teaching with a friend of mine whose daughter was ill. In 1995, I was a stay-at-home mom with my children, and her daughter got ill, and it was in a Catholic school, and she asked if I would work with her, and I said, no problem. So I started to do schoolwork with her at home, and then she was at Krause at the time. It's when we were all over the different children, and I remember my first time coming up to the hospital and going into the room and seeing all the tubes and actually getting lightheaded going, oh, my goodness. You know, can I do this? And then there was a woman who was here for 30 years. And after about 2 or 3 years, I think she was getting ready to retire. And I had developed relationships with different people.
But you were already a teacher.
I was a teacher. Oh, yes. I was a teacher. And her position, she retired. And I applied for the position, and I got it. And that's how I started my journey.
But when you experience this here, I mean, do you think there are any special things that are required for you as a teacher in terms of helping these types of students?
Luckily, when I started my position, we have an Association of National Hospital School Teachers. It's called the AECMN.
Wow.
The Association for the Education of Children in Medical Needs. And I'm a member of that. I was also a board member for many years. So we meet once a year, all hospital school teachers in one different hospital. So I've been out to different ones in Palo Alto. I've been down to Children's Hospital down in Florida. So it gives the networking that I need with other people who do the same thing that I do. There are hundreds of hospital school teachers throughout the country. In a pediatric hospital, just like ours, children are there for long periods of time. They need to be educated.
So in terms of the specialized skills, though, I mean, you have to be able to teach very young children, mm-hmm. and you have to be able to have high schoolers. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what kind of a challenge is that for you?
It's a challenge, but as I said, with the internet now and all types of technology that we have, it flows a lot easier than it has in the past.
And you had students for a number of years?
I have had students many times. Yes, I've had students that I held as babies and who are now in high school. Because of their disease, it brings them back a lot. Many of our cystic fibrosis children, many of our cancer children who have gone out of remission, who have come back. I also have children who have been in motor vehicle accidents, and I have seen them. One of the fun things is to see children in the neighborhood who will come up to me and say, "Hi, Mrs. Michelenko, do you remember me?" And I have to look and say, "I do remember you."
Wow.
Yeah, so that's
interesting. So mm-hmm. it's not really just on a short-term basis. You really do develop relationships over time.
I do.
It must be very gratifying.
It is. I just saw a girl yesterday who stopped by. She was 18 years old, and she was telling me about her schoolwork and how well she was doing.
So well, it sounds like a wonderful, wonderful program, mm-hmm. and one that I think the hospital must feel very proud of, and you must feel very proud of, and obviously doing something very, very important for these kids.
It is. It's a wonderful program, and the hospital helps, provides through the foundation, also through the advocates, and also through Lukey Soul Foundation provides any of the materials that I need, because we have to hand give the children anything that we have for infectious disease. So pencils, pens, all that kind of stuff goes. If you touch it, you take it.
I see. So there's really a lot of other requirements other than in a so-called normal school setting.
Also, yes, there is.
Well, I can't thank you enough for coming in. Very interesting, and it sounds like very, very wonderful work. Thanks for sharing it with us. My guest has been Mary Ellen Michelenko. She's the OCM BOCES hospital teacher at Upstate's Golisano Children's Hospital. Once again, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm psychologist Dr. Rich O'Neill with this week's checkup from the neck up. Grateful times five, a run-in with gravity, or gratitude meet gravity. Well, folks, research shows our minds naturally focus on the negative, on problems to solve, which doesn't make us feel happy. But research also shows if we jot down five things we're grateful for every night, we can counter this negativity bias and likely feel better about life overall in just 3 weeks. No kidding. Five gratitudes a day for 3 weeks means happier and probably sleeping better too. I started my lazy man's version of this a few months ago, skipping the writing and just thinking five gratitudes before going to snoozer land, and sometimes another five when I wake up. And it seemed to be doing the trick. Perkier. Now, the other day, I was out for a run, grateful that my 15 months of Achilles tendonitis is healing so I can run again. Well, didn't I slip on a hill, fall backwards, and kaboom, crash like a ton of scrap metal? And here, not with my ears, but from inside my body, a crack, broken rib. Whoa, big time pain, like I didn't know existed. But surprise, didn't my mind soon say, I'm glad that wasn't my head. Grateful, really. And grateful that kind Eric saw my tumble and stopped to drive me home. And grateful Margaret, the answering service operator for urgent care, stayed with me and tried three or four numbers until we figured out they'd closed for the holiday. And grateful for this thing called an emergency room, where always there experts do blood pressure, x-rays, and check the pee to make sure the rib didn't cut the kidney. And grateful for the, quote, breathe deeply into this several times a day, end quote, gizmo they gave me to prevent pneumonia from shallow breathing from the rib. And grateful the doc gave me pain meds and told me to, quote, stop taking these as soon as possible because they make you constipated and you think you hurt now. Just wait. Ouch. Hurts to laugh. And also stop them because they make the brain more sensitive to pain after just a few days. And I'm grateful for how the ER folks kept saying, oh, you poor dear, oh, you poor guy, whenever I winced or moaned, which was about every 3 seconds, it seemed. Yes, grateful, 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 grateful. Five of them. Thank you all for your expertise and kindness, folks. I'm Dr. Rich, happier, healing man, O'Neill. Thanks for tuning in.
Next up, how positive parenting makes discipline work. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And it's time for your Healthy Monday Minute for the week of January 5th. Make the first move. Regular physical activity benefits every part of your body and can reduce your risk of cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, and more. While it's recommended that adults engage in at least 150 minutes of moderate intensity activity each week, every little bit is better than nothing. It's important for you to start moving and gradually increase intensity and duration. Start strong this year by adding activity whenever possible. It can be as simple as walking while on the phone, parking at the end of the lot, or taking the stairs instead of the elevator. Think about ways to get moving this year, and have a healthy Monday and a healthy week. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. There are many conflicting theories that have been written about parenting in the last few years, from the strict tiger mom philosophy to the more permissive and potentially intrusive helicopter parenting style. So what's a parent to do? Well, here with some answers is Dr. Alicia Pekarsky. She's Assistant Professor of Pediatrics at Upstate Medical University. Dr. Pekarsky is also a board-certified child abuse pediatrician, as well as a general pediatrician at Upstate Golisano's Children's Hospital, McMahon Ryan Child Advocacy Center, as well as University Pediatric and Adolescent Center. Welcome, Dr. Pekarsky. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
So parenting, to my mind and in my own life experience, is perhaps one of the most challenging jobs that there is, and yet kids don't come with any instructions. There's no manual. There's no real training, and there's lots of conflicting schools of thought. So wherein lies the answer? I mean, in your mind, what's the central concept about what is the role of a parent?
Well, I agree, first of all. I think that I have three young children. I think that parenting is the most difficult job that I do. And I view my role and other parents' role in children's lives is to teach them about the outside world, to help them nurture relationships with people, both their peers and also adults, and also just make them feel safe when they explore the world. Clearly, their basic needs need to be met also. They need to get to school. They need to be fed, and they need to have a safe place to be.
And it strikes me also that this whole notion of socializing kids or helping them to understand what are the rules for how to get along with people, much like you said, encouraging relationships, really does start at home.
Absolutely.
And in that primary relationship with a parent. But how about helping a child learn to value themselves and their own selfhood and dignity? Do you think that's an important piece of parenting as well?
It's extremely important. I think them developing a good self-esteem and ability to relate to other people in the first few years of life actually impacts them throughout the rest of their lives.
So the stickiest part of all of this that you hear over and over again is discipline. You know, it's kind of where the rubber meets the road. How do you get what could be an unruly child or a child who wants to do their own thing, especially once they get to that so-called terrible two stage where they think they know everything and they want to do everything. I mean, discipline seems to me to often be, as I said, where the rubber meets the road. What do you think about issues of corporal punishment? We call corporal punishment spanking, physical punishment. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's interesting because you brought up two concepts that are very related, all in the same sentence, discipline versus corporal punishment, and there is a big difference. Corporal punishment, I think, has a lot of negative ramifications, and as a pediatrician, as well as a child abuse pediatrician, we strongly discourage using corporal punishment, and I think it's something that we've thought for a long time, but has been studied a lot more recently, and in the past couple of years, there's been a number of good publications indicating.
So people have actually done real studies to look at the effects of physical punishment
they
on
have.
Kids.
Yep, there's been a lot of studies. And one of the best studies that I've read is a study that was published by Ferguson et al. Last year that confirmed that spanking and other forms of corporal punishment are ineffective, and they have lots of negative ramifications.
So what does it end up teaching a kid ultimately? Does it teach them to be aggressive as opposed to
It does.
Behave?
Yeah, the kids who are victims of corporal punishment tend to be more aggressive in childhood. They have antisocial behaviors. They have poor mental health. And when they grow up, they also tend to be more likely to abuse their own children and be in relationships where there's domestic violence. They've also studied some negative, quote-unquote, medical health effects of kids who are victims of corporal punishment. They have, that's an increased risk factor when you have an adverse childhood experience like that, to have things like obesity, cancer, heart disease, all the big things that we're worried about these days.
So it has medical ramifications, health ramifications
exactly.
as well. So what does New York State say about this? I know that it's been in the news lately, that whole NFL thing with Adrian Peterson using a switch to so-called discipline his child. I mean, Is it illegal in New York State?
That's a great question because I'm asked that a lot, and it does vary from state to state, so it's important for us to know what's going on in New York State. In New York State, corporal punishment actually is allowed in homes and in some cases in private schools, but it can be considered excessive if the child has marks on their body or if the parent uses something to inflict an injury.
Such as that switch
idea? Such as the switch or using any actual implement to hit a child. The thing that's allowed legally is for a parent to use an open hand to spank on the body and not leave a mark. That's what's considered legal.
But in fact, what you just said in advance of that is despite its legality in some settings, it's clearly not advisable.
Absolutely not advisable.
So what's the bottom line here? I mean, what kind of discipline does a conscientious, compassionate parent do to coax good behavior? Especially, you know, you have these immature little humans who are still developing mm-hmm. their ability to control themselves, and they're completely capable of driving you crazy.
Absolutely.
So the question is, how do you go about encouraging this positive behavior?
So we look at positive discipline, and it's really an approach to teaching children that helps them to succeed, that gives them information, and it also supports their development and their growth.
So when you say positive discipline, is it part of this whole idea of positive parenting kind of wrapped together?
It is. I think discipline is probably one of the biggest things that goes with parenting, and they go together.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Upstate pediatrician Dr. Alicia Pekarsky. We're talking about positive parenting. So when you talk about positive parenting, what's the key, or positive discipline / positive parenting, what's the key issue here? I mean, what's the key to eliciting the behaviors that you want from a child?
I think teaching them and demonstrating to them what kind of behaviors that you want is the most important thing that you can do with your children. I think also having kind of your go-to types of discipline that work for you and your family is really important, because obviously when a child is displaying a behavior that's undesirable, it's a stressful situation for parents. Whether you're out, you know, in public or you're in your home, it tends to be stressful. And so oftentimes when parents are not prepared for that situation, they react out of anger instead of having a plan. So one of the most important things, I think, is for parents to have a plan on how they want to discipline their child.
And to know in advance, have it thought through.
Right.
But one of the keys that I've read about and thought about quite a bit is it strikes me that for positive, so-called positive parenting to take place, it really must be based in a positive relationship that's been slowly and carefully built between the child and the parent. Because to really elicit positive behavior, one would hope that the child will want to please the parent and want to sustain that kind of bond and positive relationship. I mean, that isn't sufficient. There need to be boundaries mm-hmm. set and all of the rest. But do you agree?
I do, and that's why I think that, you know, parenting from the beginning, even when you have a newborn and infant, you're beginning to start to develop a relationship with that child, your infant or baby, that's going to impact them throughout their lives. It's really important right from the beginning.
So when you say get ready, be prepared, give us some examples of the kinds of things or tips that you would say to parents when mm-hmm. it comes to things like positive discipline.
I often go back to the top 10 principles of discipline that were outlined by Dr. Kersey, who's a doctor of education, and she published a book on this about 10 years ago. So I have my kind of armamentarium of what I use in my own home, and I tend to recommend these things in my practice as well. A couple of the things that I really like, one would be what she calls the incompatible alternative principle. So if you have a child who's, you know, acting up when you're, say, out at the grocery store, you give the child another idea of something to do that's completely incompatible with them throwing a temper tantrum on the floor.
Give me an example.
So say you have the child who's about to throw themselves on the floor, and you're shopping and you have your shopping list. You give that child the job or the task of going to get 6 oranges and 3 apples, where they actually have to concentrate on something else rather than have the temper tantrum.
So in a sense, there's a distraction factor.
A distraction.
You move them away to something positive, mm-hmm. something they can get rewarded for, in a sense, from that behavior that's undesirable.
Yeah, and I think something triggers in their brains when you give them that incompatible alternative principle, because you can't do that and throw the temper tantrum. One of the other things that I really like, and I use this probably every day in my own home, is the timer says it's time principle. So setting a timer often helps with transitions for children, and I really like using this. So, for example, I'll set the timer and say, so when the timer goes off, you're going to need to put away your books. Or when the timer goes off, we know it's time to go upstairs. You can
almost giving it, it's almost, you're almost giving it an impersonal, impartial.
Right.
It's not setting up a confrontation. Mom says, therefore child resists, but rather we're just going to set the timer. And when the timer says it's time,
right.
it's time to go.
Exactly. And that's why the timer says it's time. So it's very objective. And it also works with kids. You know, if you're going to allow them a short period of time with media, which we in general discourage them to have a lot of screen time. But if you're going to give them a short period of screen time, it discourages them saying, just one more minute, or can I just finish the game? So it helps with that as well.
Do you also recommend things like a warning? Like, for example, I see the timer's only got another minute on it, to give them almost a way of preparing for those transitions before the actual cutoff
time. I do. I usually give, for younger kids, I think just the 2-minute warning usually works with them. So that's the early elementary and the preschool kids, giving them a 2-minute warning, but keeping it very simple and, again, objective. It's 2 minutes, and that, you know, and then that's it. There's no discussion until the timer goes off.
How about in safety situations where it's clear that you really must intervene?
Those situations are a little bit different. So in those situations, I think you have to act quickly. And again, it's good to still have a kind of a plan in mind for what you're going to do if your child is doing something that's unsafe. In most situations like that, unfortunately, you end up having to kind of remove the child from the situation quickly, and that's okay.
How about explaining things? This is something I keep coming through and things I've read in the very little bit of time we have left. How much explanation, and obviously it depends on the age and the ability of the child
right.
to understand, but do you advocate for explaining, I know that you're angry, but we have to do this, or I know that, in other words, some explanation along with behavioral changes.
And definitely. I think it's important to acknowledge where the child's coming from and say that you understand that they're upset about something, but still carry on with the plan so that they understand what you're trying to teach them and that you model that behavior so you get a good response the next time.
And consistently do so.
Consistently. And that's one of the big things that I think that's difficult for parents is maintaining consistency between all the different caregivers, between homes, between the teachers, between even the parents sometimes. But the consistency within yourself and also the different caregivers is really important.
So there needs to be good communication then amongst caregivers, partners in
yes,
parenting.
Absolutely.
So that everyone's on the same page. You know, we could go on and on. Unfortunately, we've run out of time, but this is so interesting and so important. I thank you so much for coming in and sharing your perspective on all of these things. And maybe you'll come back again and we can talk more.
Thank you very much for
having
me.
Great.
Yeah.
My guest has been Dr. Alicia Pekarsky. She's assistant professor of pediatrics at Upstate Medical University, board certified child abuse pediatrician, as well as a general pediatrician at Upstate Scalasano Children's Hospital, McMahon Ryan Child Advocacy Center, and University Pediatric and Adolescent Center. I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. Poet Lisa Wiley from Buffalo, New York, uses the metaphor of skin to talk about relationships, one in particular that her speaker finds painfully difficult. Here is her meditative poem, Skin. Our largest organ holds us all together, contains a bleeding heart, insipid intestines, and everything in between. The pigment really doesn't matter, but wars have been waged over it. Young and smooth, it generously expands over 9 long months and returns politely back in place. Excited when someone exposes a little too much, an early matinee. When insulted, we remember its presence. Chafed, brush burned, singed, white fingerprints on a red shoulder. Cracked and wizened, we show respect in some cultures, seek its sage advice. The first layer's dead anyway, yet when someone gets under it, not in a Sinatra way, but the way you do, the sky isn't big enough for both of us. I know we can't crawl out of it, unzip the whole suit, collapse into puddles, so I'm glad you live thousands of miles away, until the silences penetrate, and they too burrow clear through my thin epidermis.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we learn why running is more beneficial than walking, plus all about depression and what can really help, and some more groundbreaking research into a cure for retinal blindness. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLinkOnAir, that's all one word, .org. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can look for us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Jennifer Congel and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.